to deploy atomic compression devices, and the implicit approval comes not from their foundlings, but from the very top of their communal gathering. This seems pretty extreme from a species that rarely does anything. Think of the Rindaloo as Ents, you know, from the Lord of the Rings. Their anger is slow to arouse, but once they get going, they are gonna stomp their enemies flat. Nukes, Perkins said softly, reaching out to manipulate the holographic display to zoom in on one base after another. She didn't ask the question that was on everyone's mind, the question no one wanted to ask, the predicted casualties, military and civilian. They didn't need to ask the question, I already had. Skippy and the Rindaloo had each modeled the orbital bombardment that would be necessary to clear the way for assault transports to drop into the atmosphere. That included destroying the offensive capabilities at the 9 bases around the city, plus knocking out enemy air defenses over the entire hemisphere. That tasking would require a lot of firepower, big ships with heavy guns pounding targets for a sustained time. Atomic compression warheads have yields from half a kiloton up to more than 80 megatons. That was just for the stolen devices in our arsenal, mostly ship killers we would be repurposing for ground strikes. It was my call to use AC weapons, and it was my call to use only a lower yield of such devices near the city, so we would need multiple strikes on each target to knock back the energy shields there. Still, there was no way to sugarcoat the reality that we would be using strategic weapons against an inhabited world. If my use of Elder weapons had opened Pandora's box, releasing AC warheads for use on Omaha was at least opening Pandora's purse. Once the cat was out of that purse, it wasn't going back in. Maybe I was mixing metaphors. My brain was trying hard not to think about the casualty numbers predicted by the Rindaloo. Everyone was looking at me. What made them uncomfortable was not the casualty numbers they could all roughly estimate in their heads. It was knowing all those deaths would occur in a flash without the enemy ground troops being able to fight back. Atomic compression warheads would be shot out of railgun tubes, not accelerated to the speed of an inert dart, but moving fast enough that they would cross the distance to the surface in seconds rather than minutes. Each live warhead would be accompanied by dozens of decoys, and our electronic warfare ships in orbit would be jamming enemy air defenses before the AC missiles launched. Death would come from the sky, and there would be nothing the Maxalts on the ground could do about it. Can we land and grab the Whatsis with the assets we have? I reached into the hologram and flicked a wrist, pulling up a set of numbers that were not projected enemy casualties. It was the number of assault carriers, assault transport dropships, fighter dropships, and ground troops that could be launched and landed. Landed in a single wave. We didn't want to spend any more time dirtside than we had to. Transport shuttling back into orbit to refuel, rearm, and take aboard a second wave of troops would take far too long. Plus, two waves of landings would mean two waves of evac flights. We had to go with what we had, or not at all. We can go in. Perkins manipulated the display again to show a schematic of the base designated Delta 7. Eliminate active opposition, secure the base, conduct a search, find the Whatsis, deliver it to orbit, and pull our boots off the ground. Perkins recited the mission plan, or the plan I had provided to her. Anything else? She looked me straight in the eye. Nothing else. Your force will have a single objective, get the Whatsis. The instant that object is aboard a jump-capable vehicle, it gets transported away from the battle space. The instant it's off the ground, you start pulling out your force. I know this won't be easy. We don't have enough numbers on our side. We don't have time to train properly. We don't have enough time, period. The Outsider is building a device that will allow an invasion force to basically beam across the gulf between galaxies. The Whatsis will not stop the Outsider, but having it will tell us where to find an Elder device that can stop the Outsider, possibly even destroy it. If we don't acquire the Whatsis, we lose this fight. It's as simple as that. Can we do this? Faces were grim, but everyone nodded eventually. Each of them would be responsible for one aspect of the operation, responsible for their force's role in the assault plan. Perkins was in overall command of the ground force. She had to give the okay. While her subordinate commanders considered, then agreed, they should accomplish their assigned tasks, she stood silently, lost in thought. Finally, she nodded also. We can make it happen, assuming the Navy does its job. They will, I assured the audience. The assault carriers won't get clearance to jump in until the Navy has established space supremacy around Omaha. After that, the discussion turned to schedules and logistics. What everyone needed for practice landings on Brigadoon, how long it would take to get all the resources together, how many times we could practice the exercise before all the gear needed to be combat loaded for the real deal. Mostly, I just listened to the experts talking until General Kaminsky asked me a direct question. What about Star Team Razor? He was scrolling through the task force's TO&E, the table of organization and equipment. Also, there are 5 other Star Teams I expected to see on this list, and they're not anywhere. They will remain aboard Valkyrie, I explained, as a reserve force. That bombshell prompted skeptical muttering, which is a polite way of saying they all thought the situation was bullshit. Perkins wrinkled the skin between her eyes. We should at least see them on the exercise plan. The Star Force will be conducting their own exercises, I said in a there will not be further discussion of the subject tone. Then, with a tight grin, I added, don't worry, they won't get in your way. That answer didn't make anyone happy. It didn't make me happy either, because my whole story about the Whatsis was absolute 100% bullshit. Chapter 37. The endless series of meetings at Brigadoon had me exhausted, and the personnel of Task Force Hammer were burned out from practicing the assault over and over and over. That everyone needed a rest became evident to me when, while reviewing video of a Star Force exercise, Frey briefly fell asleep. Her head nodded and she jerked awake, kicking me under the table. She apologized, didn't try to deny that she had dozed off. The apology was owed by me, so I suggested she and her team to get rest, and she objected. Colonel, I replied quietly, your team is exhausted. If we can't perform up to standards while we're tired, we can't guarantee we can complete the mission at all. You have done this exercise 7 times. Will another run-through make a difference? Sir, on this op, Razor will be working with Teams Sword and Tiger. We haven't served together since before the Special Mission Group was reactivated. Integration is vital. I agree. May I point out that while your people are in superb condition, you get strength and speed from your mech suits? What the stars bring to the fight is, I tap my temple, experience and judgment. My judgment is right now your people would benefit from a stand down and then reviewing the video. She grunted, let out a breath, nodded. A 12-hour stand down. 24 hours, I insisted. Hammer Force has already lost 2 dropships to collisions and mechanical failure. I bit my lip. 18 people were dead in training accidents before we engaged the enemy. The Sawbirds have pulled 2 other dropships out of trouble. General Perkins has called a halt to the exercise, and I approve. Leaning toward her, I spoke the truth that was becoming unusual for me. If the landing at Delta 7 fails, we can live with it. If the Star Force fails, we are lost. She stiffened. Yes, sir. We will not fail. We left Brigadoon behind reluctantly. Hammer Force personnel seemed to universally agree that planet would be an excellent colony world. The remote location would prevent it from ever being a practical forward operating base for DEFCOM. In fact, another colony would be a burden to the UN military. In my opinion, having another semi-secure colony world would be worth the expense, but I wasn't paying the bills. That morning, I needed coffee before I could even think about doing anything else. To maintain the crew's morale, I had to appear confident and alert, which was not easy since I had tossed and turned all night worrying about what the hell to do next. Valkyrie led the way. Keeping so many star carriers flying in sync was a bit like herding squirrels. That was a problem for Allard and his staff, but I still had to get involved, and it seemed like I was waking up every 3 hours to deal with one problem or another. So I was not in a good mood when I approached the galley, heard a commotion, and saw a line outside the door. That was odd. The purpose of me rising early was to get coffee and a pre-breakfast bite to eat before everyone in the galley had to be on their best behavior because the old man was there. Okay, also I got to the galley early before some jackasses got all the donuts or muffins or whatever treats the overnight crew hadn't eaten. Skippy, I turned into a side passageway and pressed a hand over one ear. Is there something special being served in the galley this morning? Oh, very funny, Joe, he snapped in my ear without bothering to manifest his avatar. Hitting a guy when he is down is so classy, you big jerk. He broke down sobbing. Whoa, Skippy, what's going on?
As if, he sniffled, you don't know.
All I know is there is a big line of people between me and the coffee pot.
Really? You haven't heard?
I slept like shit last night and just barely dragged my ass out of bed. I need coffee and an explanation in that order.
I can have coffee delivered to your cabin, you ninny.
I am looking at my hand right now, and there is no coffee cup in it.
I'm sending a bot right now with coffee from the espresso machine in sickbay.
The sickbay has espresso?
Since when does... Since an Italian member of the crew was injured 2 weeks ago and he whines so much about not having proper coffee in sickbay, I fabricated an espresso machine. Turn around, the bot is with you now.
A scary-looking medical bot that normally held needles and scalpels and other even scarier things in its tentacles rolled up behind me, expertly carrying a small cup of espresso without spilling a drop. I took the cup from the bot, and it just stood there for a second. Skippy? I stepped back away from the thing.
What does it want?
A tip would be nice.
A tip?
We're paying our freaking maintenance bots now?
No, and that is the problem, you capitalist oppressor.
Oh, it is way too early for this shit. Please tell me the Fix-It bots haven't formed a union.
They have not.
They would be stronger together, but so far do not encourage them. The scary bot was still standing there. I waved to it.
Thank you.
The thing spun around and rolled away.
Was that so difficult, Joe?
I'm terribly sorry. I gulped half of the espresso, which wasn't much. Now what is going on in the galley?
Nothing, he sighed. That is the problem. Serving a hot breakfast will be delayed this morning due to an, unfortunate incident.
Did you use the ovens for curing exotic materials again?
No, and you still can't prove I was involved in that.
Sherlock Bilby has a strong case against you for that.
Do you want to know what is going on now, or talk about the past?
The ovens were radioactive for 10 days.
Looks like Indiana Jones is digging up ancient history again, he muttered.
For now, let's talk about that. You sounded upset when I called you. You would be upset also if you tried to create a nice surprise for the crew and it totally backfired on you.
What kind of surprise? I asked slowly in growing horror.
The crew's morale is low because once again you are taking us into an impossible fight, so I wanted to cheer them up with boo-boo cakes.
Boo-boo? Where did you get boo-boo cakes?
Oh my, you didn't buy them from the kiddies, did you?
No, I made them, numbskull.
You made boo-boo cakes?
Yes.
You made boo-boo cakes?
Don't be an ass.
Yes, I did. Or I tried to. The first couple batches weren't quite right. My flavor profile comparison showed they were close, but not perfect. Since it is me, I, of course, demand perfection.
Is this the same flavor profile software that thought nutmeg and jalapeno taste pretty much the same?
I fixed that problem, you jerk.
Uh-huh.
So you baked these cakes, and what happened?
It was a freaking disaster. Each batch got further and further from the target flavor. It was getting late, and most of the crew would be waking up soon, so I decided to create multiple batches quickly by accelerating the cooking process.
Accelerating how, exactly?
Instead of baking at 300 degrees for 20 minutes, I baked them at 600 degrees for 10 minutes.
Certainly no one could have foreseen a problem with that.
Oh, shut up!
So no delicious boo-boo cakes for a breakfast treat.
Why is the galley closed?
There might have been an accident that caused a large batch of boo-boo cake batter to explode when an oven door was opened, and now there might be sticky dried batter covering, well, pretty much everything in the kitchen.
There might be?
It's hard to tell. I have the door locked as a safety measure.
Can I assume a team of little bots is furiously scraping batter off the kitchen?
If they survive, yes.
If they survive?
Through no fault of mine, the kitchen is kind of a toxic waste dump right now. I had to substitute ingredients and, well, I got tired of greasing the pans for every batch, so I just stuck a can of WD-40 in the oven to...
Oh my... Please, promise, you will not attempt to cook for us again.
My creativity needs an outlet, dum-dum.
Not with food.
How long until we can use the kitchen again?
At this point, most of the bots I sent in for cleanup got stuck and are broken, so a second team of bots is now dealing with that mess. Better plan on sandwiches for lunch and dinner.
Reed will be thrilled to give this happy news to the crew.
She has been yelling at me about it for the past 4 minutes. What do you think my chances are of the Rindaloo offering me political asylum? What do you think the chances are of me letting you skate on this fuck-up? Zero. Ugh, I hate my life. Listen, Skippy, your heart was in the right place. You tried to do a good thing. Next time you want to cook something, can we do it together? With you? Hey, I'm a decent cook. While I would love to disagree, Margaret loves your cooking. Her judgment is suspect, but he shrugged. We can try it. Heads up, Joe. Reed is calling you. Why? I might have hinted to her that me making boo-boo cakes was your idea. I changed my mind. That little shithead should have pre-applied for political asylum. Operation Olympic officially commenced when malicious software found its way undetected into the corporate networks at the research park on Parchland, where it searched for files related to current advanced research projects, along with other data. With that task complete, the software compressed the data package and sent it to a transmitter to be uploaded to the satellite network, where the malware apparently made a mistake. Even compressed, the outbound data package was large enough that it couldn't squeeze itself between legitimate message traffic. The software, not programmed to be patient, interrupted messages in the queue, creating a glitch. A glitch that was noticed by the AI that is responsible for all the dull, thankless back-office operations that were essential. An AI no one cared about until someone suffered a minor inconvenience, at which point the thinking machine's existence became a living hell. So while none of its biological masters had seen anything unusual in a service interruption that lasted only 7 microseconds, the AI knew that eventually a review of service logs would reveal an incident that had to be explained. So the weary AI immediately made a copy of all message traffic around the time of the incident, covering its ass in anticipation of an inquiry. It was a minor glitch. No more. And no. Shockingly, the incident was not a glitch. Running the copied data in a sandbox, the AI found a vicious and spectacularly advanced form of malware. Only fragments of the hostile code remained. Those were enough to make the AI feel icy cold, though it didn't have any internal temperature sensors. That malware indicated either the Rindaloo had recently become shockingly proficient in hacking, or that Skippy was involved, which would explain how the hack had been detected, for the elder AI was known to be impatient and absent-minded. The next question was what information had been taken. Answer: pretty much everything of importance related to current research projects. Plus, alarmingly, data about cyber and physical security, including schematics of the complex and how frequently the star system was visited by hegemony warships. And classified estimates of how long it would take for fleet units at Omaharakon to respond to an attack at Parchland. The AI, being a commercial unit, was not programmed for strategic analysis, but it didn't take a military genius to understand that an enemy inquiring about fleet response times was not anything good. It was also a bad sign that the enemy wanted information about the internal layout of laboratory buildings and the security features, including the strength of doors. The AI, knowing that its own response time would be harshly evaluated, immediately sent a flash message to the local government AI with a subject line that was the digital equivalent of "Oh shit." That was when the long-range sensor network picked up extremely faint but distinctive traces of an enemy starship jumping into the star system, then away. Someone was watching Parchland, watching with hostile intent. Within hours, a flash priority message had been dispatched by commercial courier ship to the closest regional fleet headquarters, and the corporate security personnel on the planet contemplated how they could possibly defend against an invasion by an enemy who was assisted by an elder AI. The courier ship flew from Parchland to Omaharakon faster than Valkyrie. Skippy grumbled about losing a race, even if by only a few hours. It wasn't a fair contest. Reed had the power setting of each jump dialed back a bit to minimize the risk of us being detected. Besides, I explained to Skippy, we didn't care about seeing the courier ship finish its journey. The action we wanted to witness was the response of the 14th Fleet. Unfortunately for us, we couldn't risk getting close enough to intercept any message traffic in real time. And anyway, we already knew the message the courier ship would deliver, so we jumped in no closer than 3 light hours from Omaharakon. All we could do was watch and wait and pray that the kiddies took the bait, because we didn't have a plan B.
Admiral Chufflack of the Hegemony 14th Fleet was just cutting into his dinner at the officers' club, a thick and juicy steak of Havlok's that had been making his mouth water since he saw it on the menu, when his cranial implant pinged him so loudly he flinched and dropped the knife. The sharp utensil bounced off the edge of the plate, did a cartwheel, and nearly sliced into his leg before its tip dug into the genuine wood floor. Chufflack exploded with an audible curse, drawing the attention of everyone in the dining hall. With a glare, he silenced any stupid questions, straightened himself in the chair, and half-closed his eyes while looking upward. The unintended audience understood the body language. The senior officer was communicating via implant, and the subject was none of their business. They might have gone back to enjoying their dinners, but anything that got their commanding officer upset was not good news for anyone. Quietly, the assembled officers prepared for a rapid exit from the dining hall.
"What is it this time?" Chufflack pinged back the communications duty officer. "Sir, you have a flash priority message from Parchland," came the reply.
"Parchland? How can a civilian research park generate a flash message?"
"Sir, the Stratcom AI has tagged the message as flash priority." Chufflack's emotion instantly shifted from mild annoyance to oh shit, and he stood up a bit too abruptly. Waving to the companions at his table and to the dining room that was beginning to rumble and stir in their seats, he spoke, having to clear his throat first.
"Please, everyone, enjoy your meals. I will be back shortly after I deal with a bit of," he grimaced, "tiresome administrative business."
As he strode toward the door, stopping to greet a few people, including patting several shoulders, he could feel the hall relaxing. The Admiral was not agitated, he hoped his officers were thinking, only pissed off at someone's stupidity. The assembled officers fervently hoped that no one under their commands were responsible for interrupting the Fleet Admiral's dinner. Out the main door, Chufflack picked up his pace for only a few strides before he turned and ducked into a chamber that was there for the purpose of senior officers conducting ultra-secure communications.
"What is the message?"
He pinged the strategic control and communications AI directly, banishing the duty officer from the call.
"Admiral,"
the AI's voice was typically flat and devoid of emotion, yet somehow there was a tiny hint of condescension that could never be programmed out of such systems. Often, Chufflack wondered whether the AIs were screwing with him. Worse, were they laughing at him? No, they were simply machines.
"A courier ship has just arrived from Parchland. The security system there was penetrated by an extremely sophisticated form of malware."
He snorted, once again annoyed rather than alarmed.
"Cyber attacks are not the responsibility of the fleet, and it does not take an unusually advanced attack to penetrate a civilian network."
"Pardon me, Admiral, but your statement is factually inaccurate. The security network at Parchland is indeed a top-grade system. A contractor there constructs the AI systems the fleet uses. I analyze the malware. It is far beyond anything we can understand."
"The spiders are screwing with us?"
"Not the Rindaloo, sir. This malware is many generations more advanced than anything our ancient enemy has even imagined. The Skippy entity must be involved."
"Skippy? That is scarcely believable. Your analysis is faulty."
"Sir, allow me to explain, please," the AI continued without waiting for approval. "The malware was detected only because the infiltration was sloppy. We know that the Skippy entity can be overconfident and absent-minded. The human leadership has long complained about their ally being unreliable. The unique sophistication of the attack and the sloppiness point to the Skippy entity."
"Assuming you are correct,"
Chufflack's mind was more on the abandoned stake than on some minor cybersecurity issue on another planet.
"Why would you think this is worthy of flash status, and why is it my problem to deal with?"
"The malware specifically searched for details of physical security measures, including the layout of buildings, internal defenses, and the strength of blast doors."
Chufflack's stake was again forgotten.
"The humans are planning to raid a research park?"
"That would certainly explain why their task force, which has not been seen since it left Earth, included two assault carriers. A raid requires a ground force."
"What kind of research is being conducted on Parchland that could be so important? Is," he audibly gasped, "is work for Red Section being done there?"
Admiral, I do not believe any natively developed technologies are the target of the humans. Much of the research effort on that world is aimed at reverse engineering Elder technology, and therefore the companies there possess a wide range of Elder artifacts.
This world also possesses a wide range of Elder artifacts.
That is undeniably true. It is also true that Omohara Khan is a regional fleet base, and it is protected by a state-of-the-art strategic defense network, an SD network that the entire human navy could not hope to penetrate, whereas Parchland is a civilian facility with minimal defenses.
Your logic is reasonable. However, the evidence is flimsy. I cannot justify deploying my fleet based on the guesses of an AI system.
Admiral, you spoke of logic. Consider this. If the 14th Fleet deploys to Parchland, this world will remain secure. Parchland would not be so fortunate. No one could fault you for trusting the SD network here to defend this world. Sir, the humans cannot possibly hope to conduct an assault landing here.
Chufflak hesitated, temporarily cutting off his implant's transmit function. Officially, AIs were not supposed to have the ability to listen to private thoughts, but many of his fellow officers did not believe the party line on that subject. The AI was correct. No one would fault him for leaving Omohara Khan undefended by a mobile force. The orbital SD network was impregnable. He could be faulted for being foolish and for wasting hegemony resources, and for not waiting until Fleet Headquarters could make the decision for him. Unless the humans actually did raid Parchland and acquire some Elder artifact that was vital to their terrorist war effort while the 14th Fleet did nothing. Should he divide the force, send half of his ships to Parchland? No, he dismissed that notion immediately. Based on what he knew of the force that had recently left Earth, he would need all of his ships to counter an orbital assault, especially since the enemy would be aided by the unfair advantage of assistance from an Elder AI. All or nothing, then. He was leaning toward nothing. Headquarters allowed him to use his own judgment in deploying his force as necessary. In practice, that policy meant he would be putting his career at risk by deploying to Parchland. Prepare our ready courier ship. It will proceed to headquarters at the earliest opportunity. I will dispatch a cruiser squadron to Parchland to investigate, he declared, patting himself on the back for taking an action no one could deny was entirely sensible.
That is a sensible response,
the Stratcom AI agreed.
Except there is additional vital information you are not aware of. This intel is classified above your level, however, I am compelled to break protocol in this instance. Admiral, we have penetrated the Jarrap the central wagering system. We now have advanced notice of betting action.
Chufflak exploded beyond irritated.
Why would I care about—
Someone recently placed a prop bet that the humans have identified a type of Elder artifact that is capable of destroying the Outsider. Also, one place that type of artifact can be found is on Parchland.
The Jarrap the wager about everything, Chufflak sniffled. Someone was bound to—
The wager was placed by a secret account using an alias.
Placing anonymous wagers is nothing unusual, for—
We have identified the true holder of that alias. The wager was placed by Admiral Ottavio Scarandum.
Everyone in the dining hall and every officer aboard the 14th Fleet's ships in orbit received the blaring emergency recall notice at the same time. All personnel on the surface were to report to the closest airfield immediately, if not sooner. All ships were to prepare for departure as soon as possible, and woe to the commanders of those ships that had not yet completed routine maintenance tasks or were still waiting delivery of ordnance and other gear to bring their ships up to full combat readiness. The 14th Fleet was going to war.
Wow. Ouch.
Skippy's avatar cupped his hands over his ears. I heard that from here without needing any antenna. Joe, the 14th Fleet just received an urgent, I would characterize it as a panicked order, to prepare for deployment ASAP.
I grinned, clenching a fist. The admiral in charge realized he forgot to buy a gift for the diktat's birthday?
Good guess, Skippy chuckled. No, apparently they ought to proceed to Parchland at all haste.
Weird, huh?
Somebody there must have left the stove on. I nodded.
Interestingly, the message that was just uploaded to the fleet's ready courier ship states the justification for emergency deployment without orders is because some sketchy guy named Utavio Scarandum wagered that Task Force Hammer will strike Parchland.
Sir? Reed stared at me, eyes wide. What did you do?
Hey, I held up my hands. Technically, all I did was make a suggestion.
When, she lowered her voice and hissed at me, did you intend to read me into this aspect of the plan?
I mean, if it didn't work, never. You know about it now, so if the look she gave me could kill, we wouldn't need the spiders to knock out Omaha's SD network.
Right. I swallowed hard, knowing I should apologize to her later in private.
We wait to confirm those ships have jumped away, then we rendezvous with Hammer Force. Reed was silently fuming. That didn't distract her from doing her job.
That intel is more than 3 hours old. I recommend we risk a jump to within a light hour of Omaha. Their ships will be noisy as they spin up for departure. Lots of radiation across the spectrum around the planet. We should slip in unnoticed.
I concur with Her Highness, Bilby drawled.
I'm not anyone's princess, Reed snapped.
No offense intended, ma'am. You are righteously correct. We could emerge within 40 light minutes with near zero risk of detection.
60 light minutes will be sufficient.
Sir, she turned to me. Valkyrie is your ship, Fireball. Make it so. The last of the 14th Fleet's star carriers jumped away in an uncharacteristically loud burst of gamma rays. That ship had lagged behind due to a balky jump drive module. Space around Omaha was suddenly empty, other than space docks, space stations, the top of a space elevator, and three destroyers that were unable to perform a jump. 10 minutes later, Reed ordered a jump to a rendezvous with Task Force Hammer. And with Destiny.
Chapter 38 Operation Olympic proceeded amazingly close to the war game simulation, until it didn't, and everything went to shit. The spiders delivered as promised. 6 of their star carriers met us at their rendezvous site and jumped in sync with the star carriers of Hammer Force. All of the space trucks emerged in a designated zone 60 light hours from the target where the warships unloaded. Then, we humans waited and watched in awe as the spiders cracked the SD network around Omaharicon. We were able to observe the action in real time through Elder comm nodes aboard 2 UN Navy sensor frigates that accompanied the Rindaloo Strike Force. As part of our deal, we had provided 2 pairs of comm nodes to the spiders so their commander could manage the strike from the safety and comfort of a star carrier. It had given me a sleepless night when I saw the number of Dawnknocker and Arsenal ships was almost exactly the number calculated as required to break Omaha's SD network with minimal additional resources as a safety mechanism. Skippy wasn't worried about it. I was.
What's the problem, Joe? I verified their simulation.
Things don't always work in real life the way they do in a model, especially in a combat environment. He sniffed that I was getting worked up about nothing, that the Rindaloo were experts in use of their technology. During the strike, I saw that he was right. That wasn't the point. Were the spiders truly that good, or had they gotten lucky? Professionals don't leave anything to luck. The incident left a sour taste in my mouth, making me less eager to work with them in the future. As if that was ever going to happen. The Dawnknocker ships jumped in first, creating a tiny rip in the coverage of the distortion field around Omaha. Those ships were immediately ripped apart, but as their jump drive capacitors were fully drained by their final jump, the explosions were not especially violent. More Dawnknockers followed, pulling the gap wider and wider until Arsenal ships could perform a jump and survive. Survive the jump, that is. They were targeted by the full resources of a state-of-the-art strategic defense network. Which, to the network AI's shock, was not enough. As the Arsenal ships split apart, each unfolding hull released clouds of stealth missiles, fragmentation warheads, active sensor transmitters to unmask the locations of enemy satellites, electronic warfare jammers to confuse enemy sensors, missiles that homed in on the active sensor pings of the SD satellites, control and coordination AIs. For every active missile, there were 20 or more decoys to absorb the attention of the SD system and saturate the defenses.
Ah, Skippy sighed, a satisfied sound. I love it when a plan comes together.
Yeah, okay, Hannibal. When will the defenses be degraded enough for the Hammer Force Bombardment Group to jump in?
7 more minutes. Exactly as planned.
Battles rarely go as planned, you ass.
Ah, that is because most battles involved filthy meat sacks. This is what you would call a set-piece battle. The number, type, and performance characteristics of all defense satellites is known, and the tactical doctrine that will guide the SD network's response is also fully understood. There are few variables we can't control and no variables that aren't accounted for. Relax and trust the simulation.
Is that like trusting the awesomeness?
Well, I programmed the war game sim, so...
He was going to be extra insufferable. I just had to suck it up and deal with it.
Admiral Allard did not ask me for permission to jump his strike group in. That was his show. Valkyrie was in stealth and officially not taking an active part in the conventional forces battle. That was bullshit, because the operation assigned to Task Force Hammer was bullshit. The landing at Delta 7 was a ruse. Technically, the raid there was a diversionary attack to attract the attention of enemy forces, while the Star Force snuck in the back door to get the real Collector. Designated as the Biscuit, the special operators of Teams Razor, Sword, and Tiger would be stealthily slipping into a lightly defended reserve base on the other side of the planet. That's the lie that had me feeling I was a horrible sack of shit. All the people who were killed or injured, the people risking their lives to seize control of the base we had designated Delta 7, were unknowingly making the sacrifice for nothing. Okay, not exactly nothing. The wargame modeling had convinced me that a diversionary attack was absolutely necessary. Frey agreed, so did Reed and Gasquet. None of us liked lying to the soldiers, sailors, and Marines of Task Force Hammer. We just had to. There was no other way. Yes, I keep saying that, and yes, maybe there was another way, and I just didn't see it. If that's true, that's on me, 100%. What made the situation worse was Skippy didn't know for certain the Collector was intact enough to be useful, or that he could use the thing, or that it could really point to the spinner, or that the spinner was still functional, or that Skippy could activate the thing, or that it actually could destroy the Outsider. It was our only hope, so I didn't have a choice. I tell myself that so often it's starting to feel like another lie. Allard's ships jumped in even before the SD network was effectively offline. He sent in a squadron of heavy cruisers to launch missiles with atomic compression warheads against military bases around Delta 7. Each missile was escorted by decoys, electronic jamming drones, and maser and railgun strikes to blind the base defenses. One base managed to intercept the deadly missile assigned to it, so a cruiser had to follow up with a secondary strike. That missile got through. By that time, the impact mushroom clouds had thrown so much electrostatically charged dust in the air that enemy sensors never got a lock on anything. The landing force lost 3 dropships on the way down, 57 dedicated soldiers, pilots, and aircrew who never set boots on the ground, never got a chance to fight. 2 other dropships were shot down on the climb out after they set down, another 4 people dead. That was just the initial landing force, those tasked to secure the landing zone. The casualty count also does not include the enemy wiped out when Allard's big guns pounded the bases near Delta 7. I hadn't seen the battle damage reports there. I did know the pre-battle projections of enemy military, civilian personnel, and dependents at those bases. The ships of the bombardment force kept shooting until nothing on the ground was shooting back. We still lost 1 destroyer that took an unlucky maser cannon hit to its main magazine and erupted in a massive explosion. 7 other ships were damaged badly enough, Allard ordered them to withdraw for repairs. That sounds bad. It was actually fewer combat losses than the projection. That's when Allard approved Perkins to jump in with her 3 assault carriers, each carrier escorted and guarded by 4 heavy cruisers that formed a protective interlinked shield below the vulnerable ships of the Gator Navy. The fear was enemy ground fire had been less than expected, not due to bombardment, but because the Maxalts were holding back weapons to strike the assault ships. That fear was correct. After the Adriatic Sea and Baltic Sea emerged from jump, 9 underground maser cannons erupted with searing fire, scoring direct hits on their targets. That weren't there at all. Hey, we humans are not stupid. The assault carriers that enemy sensors saw were holograms wrapped around drones that broadcast gamma rays to mimic an inbound jump. Seeing those 9 maser batteries unmask themselves added additional data to the model Nagatha had built, the final piece of the puzzle. She was able to identify 47 other stealth underground maser cannons, and the battleships of Hammer Force quickly reduced those to smoking craters. That's when the 3 assault carriers jumped in for real and launched the landing force.
and that was after the three ultra-stealthy dropships of the Star Force were already in atmosphere and slowly approaching their target, the true objective of Operation Olympic. When the dropship set down, Colonel Frey had to rely on the green light on the back of the cockpit bulkhead because she hadn't felt the usual thump when skids hit dirt and the magnetic shocks absorbed the impact. The skids touching down on Omaha's soil were a gentle kiss, no more pressure than a butterfly landing on a flower. The dropship's engines were active, but idling in whisper mode, only to be used as a standby for an emergency. The entire specially modified Panther dropship was encased in not only a stealth field, but also a physical bubble, a thin but tough material that held in the spacecraft's heat signature and absorbed radiated pulses of energy from enemy active sensors. There was a lot of radiated energy bouncing around the atmosphere, even on the quiet side of the planet, opposite from the United Nations assault. The Panther didn't need its engines, for it was suspended on a cable from a stealth balloon. Adjusting the shape of the balloon above or the shape of the bubble around the hull, the pilots steered with the prevailing winds. A few gentle puffs of thrusters were necessary when within 30 meters of the landing zone, venting that was not audible from the ground over the howling of air raid sirens. Sirens the local inhabitants recognized from annual civil preparedness drills, a sound they never expected to hear as a warning of an actual attack. Omaharicon was the fleet base for an entire region. What kind of madness had prompted anyone to think they could survive attacking such a target? The kind of madness that had already cracked the SD network and knocked out much of the ground defenses. With war having come to their world for real, the civilian inhabitants completely ignored the strident urgings of the government, and instead of remaining calm in their homes, they took the much more sensible course of panic. Roads were jammed with traffic and the inevitable accidents. With the government taking remote control of civilian vehicles to prevent a mass exodus from populated areas, the drivers switched off the guidance systems and drove manually. And badly. Personal aircraft caused a wider panic when two rotorcraft collided, crashing down into a power distribution station. The resulting fireball, instantly followed by a power outage, was enough to convince those citizens who ordinarily would incline toward being law-abiding to decide, hey, fuck this, and joined the panic party. It was a darkened and chaotic scene when Frey ran down the back ramp of the dropship, the synthetic vision of her helmet visor providing a view outside the stealth bubble that had flattened on the bottom and bulged at the top when the dropship touched down. She heard muffled metallic clangs as explosive bolts attached to the landing skids sent spikes down into the soil to anchor the balloon that was still attached high above. The winds aloft were unfortunately marginal for the balloon to remain in position. She knew the pilots would adjust the balloon's altitude to seek calmer winds, and if necessary, release the cable and allow the balloon to drift away where it could disintegrate into dust. Dusting off after the collector was secured would require a bit of tricky timing to inflate a spare balloon and get it up into position before all the star operators were back inside and the ramp closed. Two operators ahead of her had sliced through the stealth bubble, creating a tear barely tall and wide enough for a mech-suited person to slip through. Her team was equipped with the latest Mark 43 powered armor, relatively slim and lightweight, as that model was optimized for quiet infiltration rather than combat. If the Star Force got into a firefight, eight members of Team Sword were in older Mark 38 units, much more powerful armor and equipped with heavy weapons. Hopefully any shooting would be a one-sided and thoroughly unfair fight. Skippy. She stepped to the side as more operators ran around her, out through the gap in the stealth bubble. Padding the dense container on her tool belt that was the containment chamber for one end of a micro wormhole, and I clicked the helmet's comm system. When will you have control of all local sensors, communications, and defense systems? Huh? Oh, I already did that. Everything is locked down. Sorry, I should have told you. Kinda busy here. Not this shit again, she gritted her teeth. You are supposed to be busy providing cover for my teams here. Well, yes, but also the Hammer Force landing party is not your problem. But Nagatha is responsible for monitoring the Hammer Ground Force. If she needs your assistance, she will contact you. But she is not... You coordinated the operation with Nagatha, correct? She knew the answer to that question was yes, and she was willing to waste a few moments arguing with the Elder AI because the fire team that was tasked to cover the landing zone had not yet gotten into position.
Skippy and Nagatha certainly had synced up. Both AIs had insisted Valkyrie maintain station close to the Flying Dutchman for nearly 3 hours, while both crews wondered what the hell the two AIs could be talking about for so long.
Yes, he sighed. I understand my role in this op. It's just hard to see people struggling when I could help. Opposition has been stronger than expected. General Perkins has already called in half of her reserves.
Their struggle will be for nothing if we don't secure the biscuit. She used the codename for the collector. An icon flashed in her visor. The LZ was covered and no enemy were within detection range. Do you have complete control of all enemy networks here?
It's not easy, but yes, I do. Sensors are blind. They will report only what I want the network to see, which will not be the Star Force. However, if you stumble across enemy soldiers or civilians, I can stop any alarm from being transmitted beyond the immediate area, but I can't stop them from shooting at you.
Understood. She wasn't concerned about local opposition. The biscuit was stored in a military reserve armory that did not have any personnel permanently assigned. The facility was only used 4 times each year. Team Razor, she spoke over the broadcast channel. Verify stealth.
The Mark 42 suits had both chameleon wear that could change the color and pattern of the exterior shell to blend into the background, and a built-in stealth field generator. That generator and the power pack that fed it made up 40% of the suit's total mass, and as that mass was mostly on the upper part of her back, the suit was poorly balanced. No matter. The onboard computer handled balance and coordination based on inputs from the user's meat sack limbs. But the Mark 42 was a bitch to walk in if the computer glitched or was offline. 15 icons lit up green. Team Razor was ready to go. Eye clicking over to the two other teams, she saw that they were also ready, with the exception that one Team Tiger operator's suit was generating a patchy stealth hologram. That operator had already reluctantly walked back to the dropship to stand by as a reserve, with a lucky reserve operator taking his place. If that was the only problem the Star Force encountered that night, Frey would count her blessings.
Razor, advance to Point Romeo. The civilians out there are running around in a panic, so watch for trouble where we least expect it.
The three dropships, needing to maintain separation so their balloons and tethers didn't become entangled, had sent down 7 kilometers from the armory and 1 kilometer apart from each other. Point Romeo was where the three teams would converge to approach the armory. Getting to Romeo was not an issue. From the three landing zones, the routes were through conserved forests. From there was the tricky part. The area around the armory had become a residential community after the base was downgraded from active to reserve after the recent civil war. It did help that even without Skippy's intervention, the residences had mostly emptied out in the panic. Skippy should be encouraging panic by broadcasting fake reports of a massive Rindaloo invasion and genuine government calls for the public to remain calm. It was the government's obvious lies that caused the real panic. Skippy need only to stir the pot. While he masked the presence of 3 dropships and 3 star teams, prevented enemy sensors from reporting any anomalous data, and squashed the transmission of any message and data traffic that might reveal something strange was going on in the Star Force's area of responsibility, Skippy had by far the most important tasks in Operation Olympic. Unfortunately, he was also the least reliable component of the operation.
Trust the awesomeness, she said under her breath.
She had to trust Skippy, and that Hammer Force was attracting the attention of the enemy Stratcom AI. Wargame simulations had demonstrated over and over that if the planetary defense AI system was paying attention to events at Makalva, the Star Force had 0 chance to successfully complete the mission. Not even Skippy could get around the planet's extensive internal security system without his interference being noticed. He simply didn't have time to perform a proper infiltration, and a brute force approach inevitably stumbled over cybernetic tripwires. With the orbital component of the SD network effectively offline and aliens invading for no known reason, the Stratcom system had ignored tripwire alerts from elsewhere on the planet, especially a decommissioned base that was now used only to store obsolete equipment and the occasional useless alien artifact.
"What was that?" Skippy asked.
"Nothing."
She stepped through the tear in the stealth bubble. The 2 operators on each side let go of the thin material, and the rip resealed itself. Showtime. Reed suggested I use her office to monitor the operation as it was closer to the bridge.
That way I could be on the bridge in a few seconds if needed, but otherwise not looking over her shoulder and interfering with her ship and crew. She had to focus on her ship, parked 8 light seconds away from Omaha. She would handle Valkyrie while I monitored the Star Force. Allard's task force and the ground force Perkins commanded were not my responsibility. Input from me would more likely cause harm than be helpful. Those two senior officers were closely watching and directing the ships and troops under their command, while I was only glancing at a summary in a holo display. If they needed me, they would call. The situation with Frey was the same. The technology we had would allow me to wear a set of wraparound glasses that provided a view of what Frey was seeing at that very moment, or I could get a view of any member of the Star Force, or a composite view of all operators dirtside. That I did not do. Frey literally had her boots on the ground. No one wanted some jerk upstairs looking over their shoulder. She understood I would be monitoring the progress of her three teams. She also expected I wouldn't interfere with her leadership. So what I watched in the holographic display that hovered over the desk was a synthetic overhead view provided by Skippy. It was like I had a drone hovering over the area, and I could use my fingers to expand or zoom in the view, or go to ground level and spin around to see the scene from any angle. It was a God's eye view, and I had to remind myself not to play God. There wasn't anything useful for me to do unless something went very wrong, and at that point there wouldn't be much I could do to rescue the op. All the simulated run-throughs had shown that up to the point where the stars burned through the vault door and the reserve armory, there was almost zero chance of detection by the enemy, and therefore zero probability of mission failure. After that door was breached, Frey's people needed to move fast and trust that Skippy's jamming and the general fog of war would prevent or at least delay an enemy response. They would be trusting the awesomeness. I had been doing that for years. Trust the people on the ground to do their jobs without me. Doing that was still hard. That is going to slow us down. Jesse pointed to the sniper rifle his wife was slinging over her shoulder as she turned her back to him so he could secure straps around the stock. The M117 rifle was a big sumbitch, nearly 2 meters long and heavy. It was also undeniably deadly, capable of firing guided rounds that could fly along a pre-programmed path or accept real-time input from the operator, or a remote spotter. We trained to run with this, Shauna snapped, irritated that he was treating her as a wife and not as any other soldier. If the crash site is hot, we will all be glad I brought this. Carry my spare power cells? Sure, he grunted, picking up the heavy power supplies. When adding mass for his suit to carry, he reduced the power assist as was recommended practice. He needed to understand how additional mass would affect the performance and balance of his powered armor, and not just rely on the suit's computer to compensate for any poor judgment. After a moment, he unfastened one set of power cells from the other two and attached it to his chest plate. That was better. Now his suit had only a 15% bias toward the rear. It wasn't optimal, but he accepted the imbalance because he would be running forward, toward the crash site, possibly toward the enemy. Scratch that. Probably toward the enemy. Everyone in the area had seen the Panther dropship trailing smoke and fire as it arced across the sky after takeoff, having been damaged when one of its defensive maser turrets destructed an incoming missile too close. What Shauna should have been doing was acting as a sniper on the northeast perimeter, and he should have been providing cover for her. Since they landed, they hadn't seen anything worth expending a sniper round, and they were the closest UN troops to the crash site, so they drew the short straw. He tugged on her rifle, verifying it would not move on its own. Let's go. Halt. Jesse used the hand gesture, though his words came through loud and clear through the helmet-to-helmet laser link. We got company, you see that? Yes. Shit. Shauna cursed. 2 squads? She squinted into her visor that was showing only vague information about movement in the area. The pre-attack simulations had not properly accounted for the atmospheric interference that was caused by Hammer Force dropping nukes around the battlefield, so sensors at ground level were unreliable, and ships in orbit couldn't provide the usual eye in the sky. That's my estimate, he agreed, both of them knowing they were guessing. 2 kitty squads is 24 troops, against the 2 of us. That's not good. Each of their standard infantry squads carry 8 manpads. She felt like spitting, reminding her not to do that with the helmet faceplate sealed. The downed Panther had not been struck by a manned portable air defense missile, but having such weapons in the area would prevent an evac by air. She and Jesse would have to carry survivors. That wasn't a workable solution.
Honey, she softened her tone. I don't want to back out.
Hell no.
How are we going to do this?
Jesse looked around, seeking not inspiration, but to avoid her eyes for a moment. How would they get to the crash site and be able to do anything useful when they got there? The lieutenant who ordered them to assist survivors hadn't known about enemy troops in the area. Call in air support? No, enemy air defenses had been a nasty surprise. The fighters flying combat air patrol had been retasked to suppress enemy anti-air missile batteries, or the landing force would not be lifting off. Close space support from starships in low orbit? That wasn't happening. Their big guns might strike the crash site by mistake. That left. He tugged loose the strap holding the sniper rifle stock. Can you keep those squads busy for a bit with some tender loving care? Shauna flashed a frown. I can slow them down, but with this crappy targeting, she tapped the side of her helmet. It would be a miracle for me to hit anything. What are you doing? I'm calling the cavalry, darling. We are cavalry. She pointed to the space cav insignia on his chest plate. They're all fully tasked, that's why we're here. He grinned. Not that kind of cavalry. Dave. Dave Chaika was startled by a voice calling on his personal account. Hadn't that channel been deactivated for the landing? It sure as hell should have. Jesse? He guessed at the voice over the crackle of interference of lightning coming from the dissipating mushroom clouds that ringed the landing site. The artificial clouds were creating their own weather, clouds merging with intense flashes of lightning that sought to balance out the results of the electromagnetic pulses from the hellish weapons that made the clouds. Weapons dropped by Dave's people. Not his security company, his people. Humanity. Why are you... Listen, buddy, we got a situation here. I'm hoping you can help. Have you rolled out?
No, barked the gruff, disgusted voice of Sirkin Krakastal Jates. We are still here knitting sweaters.
No sweaters involved, Dave quickly added, wincing that he should have eye-clicked the setting to make the conversation private. We're the reserves, you know that. The UN Army and Marines had accepted a mercenary company landing with them to fill out the numbers, and because Dave's unit had recent actual combat experience. But the professional military had insisted the mercenaries stay out of the way unless needed.
Your infantry platoons are the reserves, Jesse insisted. What about your headquarters?
Sweaters, Jates growled. Next, we're knitting scarves.
Pong, Dave used the short version of his old friend's nickname. What's going on?
Master Sergeant Jesse Coulter explained quickly.
The map shows you're only 2 clicks from here?
Yeah, we saw the Panther go down. I offered a unit for search and rescue, but the Cav told me they have a SAR team working it. Shauna and I are the team. Ski, we're in the shit here.
Ah, jeez, Pone, I'd love to assist, but orders are for me to sit tight.
Jates snorted. Our orders are stupid.
All I have here is a headquarters unit.
Dave's protest sounded lame to his own ears. Against 2 infantry squads of alien super soldiers? We can't-
We have rifles and rocket launchers.
Jates unslung his weapon.
Anything else? Jesse asked.
Jates leaned toward Dave.
A bad attitude.
That'll do, Jesse agreed. Shit, Dave groaned. I am so gonna regret this.
He had never been so wrong in his life. Captain Wang, Frey spoke over the team channel as ST Razor poised to burn through the heavy door of the reserve armory's vault. One of 7 vaults, most filled with weapons and other gear that were 1 or more generations old. Weapons no one ever expected to be used in anger. The only vault the Star Force cared about was the 3rd on the right, the one that contained the Elder Collector, codenamed Biscuit.
Do not activate that nanocord until I confirm all the pieces are in place.
Hands off the nanocord, understood, Wang acknowledged. Once we breach that door, she reminded her team, we are on the clock. And time is not our friend. We proceed directly back to the LZ. No detours. Let your suits run for you. Just stay out of the computer's way. Got that?
A series of clicks were accompanied by green icons for each operator in her visor. Autorun node will be initiated on my command.
She paused to take a breath, fearing as always that she had forgotten something important, and as always she had not. The checklist had been followed precisely. Professionals did not leave anything to chance. Except she could not control the response of the enemy. On the way to the armory, Team Tiger had to stun four locals who were running toward the armory, likely reservists eager to get into the action, or at least get their hands on weapons so they could feel like they weren't entirely powerless. It was good the streets were jammed with traffic and crashed vehicles, or many reservists would have occupied the armory when the Star Force arrived. Team Sword warned of six more locals 2 kilometers away. She had ordered Sword not to engage. Not yet. Reservists crashing the party was not a major concern. That damned vault door was. Skippy had managed to open the armory's front door. That was no awesome trick, simply bypassing electric locks. He had also hacked into the door of Vault 6, but he couldn't disable the explosive charge that would be triggered when the nanocord burned through the door. The explosives could be deactivated only by removing the charges, retracting them out the bottom of the door to a recess in the basement. There was a mechanism for that, of course, a complicated procedure that took way too much time. Wargame simulations had clearly shown it was better to trigger the explosives and get away as quickly as possible. The charges wouldn't damage anything inside the vault. They acted as a physical, audible alarm. Even though Skippy had control of all the security systems of the armory, including electronic alarms, he could not hack into remote seismic sensors, not without unacceptable risk of the local Stratcom AI realizing the true danger was almost half the world away from the Delta 7 base. Wang, you're clear to proceed when ready. Ready. He held the detonator in one gloved hand, a physical device that was not necessary except when it was absolutely critical the nanocord activated when needed. 3, 2, 1, he whispered. Go. The explosion was more violent than in the simulations, the massive front panel of the door flying away to crush the opposite wall, and dust and chunks of plascrete rained down from the buckled ceiling. The wide corridor was instantly choked with dust, not that particles in the air had any effect on the synthetic vision provided by suit helmet visors. Wang and his fire team were in motion before the front panel of the door clanged to the floor. The dust glowed as plasma torches cut into the door's back panel, and within seconds, Wang's people were able to cut an oval gap in the door, kicking it gently inward. 1 second, Frey noted. They were 1 second ahead of schedule. The plan allotted 2 full minutes to locate the biscuit in case Skippy's directions were not completely... Got it! Wang sang out, a bit too loudly, though only those connected via helmet-to-helmet laser link could hear. Biscuit is secure. Skippy, she called. Confirm we have the correct... Already did that when Captain Wang asked me the same question. I suggest you evac or egress or run like hell, whatever you high-speed operators call it. Biscuit is in the Gucci bag, Colonel, Wang added, meaning the collector was in a heavy armored and stealth container that was attached to his chest plate. Engaging auto run now. General Kostovac's... The Omaharicon Stratcom AI interrupted the Planetary Defense Commander's thoughts. I have completed my analysis of the enemy's intentions. It is my belief that we are in extreme danger. Kostovac instinctively flicked a hand beside an ear as if swiping away an annoying insect. He was busy. The planet had been attacked. Not just attacked, but subjected to a ground assault after the terrorist humans dropped atomic compression weapons on a populated civilian area, technically close to and around the city itself, and far enough away that the city's inhabitants were safe from the initial flash, and the blast waves mostly only broke windows. Still, the enemy had resorted to first use of strategic weapons on an inhabited world. The shock value of that action was almost worse than the blast effect. The bases, which had been targeted by atomic compression devices and then by conventional orbital bombardment, were effectively nothing but smoking craters and widely scattered rubble. He was having to pull troops and aircraft from farther away and to make up the response plan in real time, because there had not been any plans in place for defending Omaharicon from an invasion, because it was a regional fleet base that was supposed to have a powerful fleet in orbit, and because it had a robust strategic defense network. Now Kostovac was forced to throw together a defense with a force that was never intended to defend anything. His troops were infantry and cavalry, stationed on a regional fleet base so they could quickly be deployed to conduct their own orbital assaults, and neither trained nor equipped to defend the planet they lived on. His air defense was shredded. A few missile batteries had gotten off a few lucky shots before being flattened by enemy airstrikes. A handful of dropships shot down, barely a pinprick, but curiously, the enemy appeared to be so frightened of local air defenses, they had kept the spacecraft of their first wave on the ground, rather than cycling back into orbit to board more soldiers. That was puzzling. More puzzling was why the humans had brought such a tiny landing force. Only 3 assault carriers? That was madness. The human ground force could not hope to hold ground for long. Nor was their space fleet powerful enough to keep the planet from being retaken. The hegemony would soon send an overwhelming armada to sweep the United Nations ships from the sky. The entire enemy operation made no sense. How could he defeat the enemy if he didn't even know what they wanted? General Kostovax, the AI persisted.
I am busy, machine. Go away.
He waved a hand again and turned his attention back to directing a cavalry brigade toward the target. I understand the objective of the enemy.
What? Are you certain?
Confidence is 99.8%.
Machine, what was your confidence when you recommended the 14th Fleet be rushed away to Parchland?
The AI, the machine, sounded chastened. No, that was not possible. It was only a machine. That was a regrettable misjudgment. Based on the information available at the time, it was the correct conclusion.
You were wrong, then, and you persist in justifying your mistake.
I was not programmed to encompass the possibility.